time to wake up with Bill Finch. 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
Well, welcome to Wake Up with myself, Bill Finch, the host, and Victoria Woodard. We're taping today's segment because, lucky me, I'm going to be on a little mini vacation. But Vic is here in the studio with our big honcho here at WICC and Weeby and Fox Radio, one and only Alan Lamberti. Thank you, Alan, for your help. We're here today to talk with Diane Parrish, who is just published her first book. And, of course, as you know, as a listener to Wake Up on Sunday mornings on WICC AM and FM, you hear a segment every week about a book that's been banned. And sometimes readers are incredulous that Captain Underpants has been banned or The Lorax has been banned or some child's book has been banned. And there's a lot of crazy extremism, as we know, in politics today. But we try to give you an understanding of why books are being banned, on what basis they're being banned. And as Vic is a mom of two young kids, active in her local library group, which is focusing on banned books in Orange, Connecticut here, she tries to give parents some kind of guidance, right, Vic? I mean, on the age appropriateness, not banning books, but what kind of a parent do you want them to be?
Yeah, be an advocate. We don't like to ban books. You know, our kids aren't going to learn anything if you take things away from them. We've just got to guide them and be present and, you know, help them learn from the things they're reading instead of removing the possible exposures because we are uncomfortable as adults.
You know, it's funny because I've been in politics for, well, about 60 years now, well, over 50, Diane. And, you know, the way these extreme groups work is they fan the flames of fear to raise money. You know, if they really wanted to ban books, they wouldn't put them on a list because then every kid wants to read the banned books. I would suggest if I was an author like you, I'd want my book on a banned list. What about you, Diane? Would you like your book on a banned list?
Well, yeah, if they put it on the front page of the New York Times, go for it.
There you go. And hey, I want to just introduce Diane's book for a second. So, Diane, you recently published your first book, Something Better. Right. And
yes.
I did read it. It was wonderful. Thank you for sharing
you.
That.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, special place in our heart, of course, because you are local. You're from Westport, Connecticut. So audience, hey, go out and get Diane's book. It is available. I believe I got mine on Amazon through the Kindle store. So you can get it digitally.
I'm sure it's in the
as well.
Phenomenal Westport Library. Right, Diane?
It is in the library. It's in the Westport Barnes & Noble. It's online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop, kind of everywhere.
Perfect.
I think we could actually have Vic a show down at the Westport Library. They have a studio like this. Maybe we should bring Alan down there someday and look at the studio and broadcast from the Westport Public Library. But keep talking about the book, Vic. I want the listeners to hear about Diane's, you know, she's been working on this a long time, right?
Yeah, Diane, talk to us about that. I did watch a couple of your you know, interviews and things like that right around the time of release. And it sounds like you've been writing this book for quite a while. Can you talk to us about, you know, what brought you to this being your debut novel and how long it kind of took you to get here?
It did take me a long time. I wouldn't say I was actually writing the thing for all those 15 or so years. I had the idea for the book around the time the book is set, around 2008, 2009, because I was observing two pretty dramatic situations that called for forgiveness. I can tell you more details about that if you want. But in one of the situations, the people involved were able to forgive each other and go on and have a life together. In the other situation, they were not, even though one of the people involved was terminally ill and that person died with no resolution between the two. And I just kept thinking, Why in some circumstances is it possible and in other circumstances it doesn't seem to be? And so as I was thinking about forgiveness, I was actually in a study about forgiveness, and I kept imagining a scenario where forgiveness would be demanded of a lot of different people. And then these people popped in my head, Annabeth and Ruth and David, and started telling me their story. So I started writing it, and I'm a lawyer, but I'm not a trained fiction writer. So I had a lot of self-doubt about whether I should even be doing this thing. So I start it and stop it and start it and stop it. That's why it took forever and a day to write the thing.
Well, writing is hard. I mean, it's such an elaborate process. You kind of have this thing in your brain, right? And it's like, how do I get this on paper in a way that will resonate with readers who may not understand all that history of these people that you do know? And, you know, you said you're a lawyer as well. So even from that perspective, being that, you know, Ruth was a lawyer as well, right?
Right.
So just kind of making those connections.
Ruth is the main character.
One of them,
yes. One of the main characters.
One of them, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm crazy, but I've written a lot of books in my head in the twilight hours, laying in bed. I've got a bunch of chapters, and then I sort of, you know, wake up and make the comment and I forget the whole chapter I just wrote. But, you know, sometimes we have all these visions and ideas. We really need to try to figure out a way to capture them. Maybe they're going to create an app for my brainwaves, and I'm going to be able to capture these. I've written some bestsellers, I'm sure of it, you know.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't mean to minimize it, because I know, and it's sort of what Vic's getting at here, is the writing process is arduous. You know, you read about how some people write, you know, going off into their little shed, like David McCullough used to do, on a manual typewriter in a shed off from the house, and being isolated. What's the method of your writing? How do you isolate and concentrate?
Actually, a lot of my writing still takes place when I'm walking. I'll go on a long walk and really get in my head. When I first started writing this book, I would go on a long walk and have passages or maybe a full paragraph, and sometimes just the plot trajectory, but other times almost a verbatim paragraph in my head. And I would keep repeating it for the last part of my walk until I got in the door, and then I would grab a legal pad and a pen and write it down as fast as I could. Other times now that we have smartphones with voice memos on them, I still compose in my head while I'm walking, but I can grab my phone and record what I'm thinking, which is much, much easier. And then the process of, you know, your early morning thing, you are dead on about early morning. My daughter is also a writer. She teaches writing, in fact, at Driftwood University. And her advice is, do not even make that coffee, Bill. Just get up in the morning before you do anything else.
You don't understand. Whatever. I've already made myself do mental gymnastics to do my push-ups and my sit-ups. So the coffee is my reward, you know, and then writing would be another thing I got to discipline with. I can't be that disciplined to run out of bed.
I hear you, because I can't do it either. But her advice is just go right to the computer or piece of paper or whatever, however you record your words, and before you can edit yourself and stop the flow of creativity, just get it down some way. And then later in the day, after you've had as much coffee as you want, you've done the things you need to take care of, come back and take a look at it and try to clean it up. That doesn't work for me because I can't stand messes. I tried it a few times and I'd have this big mess of words. And when I went back to clean it up, I thought, oh, no, I don't like this big mess. I have to write more in a more controlled fashion than that.
Well, we're coming up on a little break here, but, you know, one of the things we could talk about is how hard it is to write a book, how hard it is to get published. And then if you do all of that, and then all of a sudden some do-gooder group out of left and right field comes in and says, your work shouldn't be read by anybody. Half the time they don't even read the book, you know, before they before they censor it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and when I was reading your book, I was trying to put it through the lens of book banning, right? Because that's kind of my gig here, is talking about book banning and why I'm so vehemently against it. And I was kind of trying to think through where there are themes in your book that might be off-putting to some or might trigger people to want to ban it. And so I think, you know, we can talk a little bit about that just as an opening to that before we break. I think, you know, this book has some faith-based elements and some religion in it that might be triggering. There is, you know, some adultery. There's things like relationships that are spanning generations. So I think there are areas we can touch on as well after the break.
Wonderful. We're going to break for a few minutes and we'll be back with author Diane Parrish from Westport, Connecticut. Thank you, Diane. Hold on. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation. 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch. live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And we're back on Wake Up here every Sunday morning on WICC AM and FM. And I'd like to thank Connoisseur Media Group for giving us the microphone and be able to talk about such timely topics of public policy that really affect all of our lives. And as we enter the next 4 years, where half the country is scared, the other half the country is celebrating for the same reasons that we're scared. We really need to have an outlet for people to talk and be civil to one another and try to work out our differences without the things like January 6th. So, Diane, we're here talking with you, a local author who's worked for several years on her first book, and it's getting good reviews. It's in the Westport Library. It's in local libraries. And we're also joined with Victoria Woodard, who is a member of the Orange Library Band Book Club. And Vic, you were talking about the process a little bit of what Diane went through. And why don't you keep on that subject and some of the subject matter she's dealing with in the book that may be controversial to some people. And by the way, if the show here doesn't have a little controversy, if a book doesn't have a little controversy, you got to hold people's attention, right?
Well, right. I mean,
so I'm about ready to streak through the studio here to create some. No, just kidding.
Yeah, I'm going to vote against that personally. You know, I think I will be the first to say I read pretty much anything somebody puts in front of me. Right. I'm up at, I think, 218 books this year. So
well done.
Yeah, it keeps me motivated. Audiobooks during the day and then physical books in the evening.
So I got to add in here. I just looked. I didn't do this before, but do you have a Libby account, Diane? A public library account?
A Libby account?
Libby.
Oh, well, I have a public library account to check out books from the Westport Library. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and you can get audiobooks through their app. It's called Libby. Mm-hmm. And when the first catastrophe happened in 2016, I swore off anything but listening to WICC. And I didn't read newspapers. And I just checked my timeline, and I'm up to about 1,000 books since 2016.
Wow. It's amazing.
Because you put one, you close one down, and you open up the next one that you've queued up and you've been having on hold from the library. And it's just the most, I would encourage anybody listening to set up a Libby account and listen to books. It calms you down and it informs your mind. But Vic, you were on a track here. I didn't mean to distract
No,
you.
It's all good. I huge advocate for Libby and our public libraries. So happy to take that little
pivot.
Need
an applause
there.
Line here, Ellen, for
the
libraries.
Yeah. No, our librarians, our public librarians, our school librarians, they are civil servants like nobody's
unsung
business.
Unsung heroes.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. They're on the front line.
Yeah, I mean, for kids, for adults, and I don't
imagine
mean to...
when they went to college, did they study how to handle crazy parents coming and screaming at them about something that's on the shelf they didn't even know was on the shelf?
You know, it's I'll sidebar for a second here, right? My kids and I go to the library regularly, and then you know we do use Libby and any avenue to get books, right? Really, and I can't say enough. You know, we walk into our public library and the children's librarians, not only do they know my kids, they know what my kids like. We walk in and we can say to any of them, hey, what should, you know, Caleb or Colby take out today? And they just will take the kids off. They'll recommend books. They'll talk about things. My son is, you know, he's big into manga and anime, and that's not.
My kids were too, yeah.
It's not my thing, and so I don't.
You got to read the books backwards, too. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's incredibly artistic, right? But it's not my thing. So I love that I can walk into our library and say, hey, you know, is this appropriate? Tell me what I have to watch out for. Tell me what I should be, you know, looking for in terms of are there themes that might be questionable? And they will give me real answers and they'll call it out for me so that I can help guide my son in the appropriate direction. And I think that's where we're missing things is, you know, I'm not going to bash people's parenting styles, but I really do think in terms of media content, we need to be active participants. Banning these books isn't going to help our kids, but talk to your librarians, talk to your kids, have the conversations and figure out, you know, okay, if there is a sensitive subject, then cool, I'm going to read the book first. And then we'll make the decision together whether you can read it. And if you can, whether we need to have those conversations later.
Constructive parenting.
Yeah. So I'm sorry about that tangent.
Well, not absentee parenting. Like, no, just ban the books and I don't have to think.
Yeah, no, I'm not down with that. So Diane, in your book, there are some themes. There's a lot of prayer, which surprised me as I went through. It was kind of like a subtext that I wasn't personally expecting. Tell me about that a little bit and, you know, kind of how that came into your process and whether that was related to the relationships you did know of in real life or if something else kind of inspired that.
Well, it was related to the relationships I knew in real life. And it also, talking about things that you're not supposed to put in books, when I first was pitching this book to agents, one of my first experiences was I was in a pitch and publish online thing, and I was just assigned a random agent. I didn't have a choice, and she didn't have a choice. And after I was assigned to her, I went to her website and read what she was looking for, and it said, the first line said, nothing religious or spiritual. I'm like, uh-oh, this is not going to be a match made in heaven. And it was not. It was not a match made in heaven. But I had also read an article in the New York Times. I wish I could remember. I will remember in a minute. By an author it was around 2000, around the same time, 2008, I want to say. And the title of the essay was, Has Contemporary Fiction Lost Its Faith? And his point was, somewhere along the line between Graham Greene and where we were then, no one who wrote literary fiction included any characters who were believers, or very few. If you encountered a believer in a contemporary novel, you could pretty much bet they were going to be a right-wing lunatic, a member of a cult, or seriously damaged by religion in their lives.
So which one do you fit in? I don't think you fit in any of those.
No, and you know, your characters didn't fit into any of those either.
No. Well, that's why I included one who was, well, more than one, I guess, but one who primarily was because I know lots of people of faith and they're none of those things. And I thought it's time to put a person who's just a normal person who happens to be a believer in the middle of a work of contemporary fiction and show the inner workings of her mind and how she lives her faith in a way that's not completely crazy. So I really wanted to do that. But that was, yes, that was something that helped that tripped up a lot of people. And then oddly enough, on the other end of the spectrum, a different agent said to me, well, this is similar in a way. She said to me, well, if you want to sell this book, you have to take all the references to faith out of it, and you have to make the sex a lot more graphic. And I was thinking, well, aren't there about 12 million books like that already sitting on the shelves? And that's not the book I want to write. I want to write this book. So I stuck to my guns and made my life a little bit harder. But now that the book is out in the world, I can sigh it, you know, heave a sigh of relief because it is the book I wanted to write. It's not the book somebody else thought I should write.
You know, I really appreciate that too, Diane, because another one of my favorite fairly local authors, Annabelle Monahan, she writes romance and it is all, you know, what we refer to as closed door, right? So there are no graphic scenes. You know, there's some romance that leads up to the proverbial closing of the door. And, you know, she kind of similarly, when I had met her in the past, had said that she just didn't feel comfortable writing that. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great.
I have to make an admission. I read all the 50 Shades of Grey books. All right. And I can't tell you that I remember anything about them. They were vapid and superficial and...
Yeah, not well written in my personal opinion.
I mean, almost as poorly read as all the Ayn Rand books, which are the worst written books I've ever read. But anyway, won't get into that. But, you know... They don't remember. They're not memorable. I mean, you read them for the moment because everybody else is reading them and it may be a little titillating, but.
Right. That's not the plot. That's not the story. And I think, I know we have a break coming up again, but I think one of the things that I really appreciated in the way that you wrote this was I think, you know, faith came into play in a fairly subtle and tactful way, but it was also thread throughout the book and through multiple characters, not just, you know, not just Ruth. And it impacted them each differently, which I thought was, you know, a nice touch. And again, nobody was, you know, a crazy.
And you read it for character development. You didn't read it for the salaciousness.
Exactly.
Of it.
Yes, exactly.
So we're going to take a quick break here and come back with Diane Parrish, author who makes her home here in Westport, Connecticut, which has always been open to the artistic community in so many ways with the Westport Country Playhouse and the various art galleries and whatnot. It's a wonderful town for the arts. You're in a great town to be a writer and a creative person. So we're going to come back with Diane and Victoria Woodard and with Alan Lamberti here in the Connoisseur Studios on Wake Up.
Talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake Up with Bill Finch. WICC 695.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And we're back on Wake Up. Happy Sunday morning to everybody. We're taping the show, so we're hoping that it's a happy Sunday morning. Nothing's happened between the time we're taping it and the show. Again, we're here with Diane Parrish from Westport and Victoria Woodard of the book club at the Orange Library that focuses on banned books. And now we want to get into a little bit of the politics that are going on. You know, right now it's the far-right Christian nationalists that are leading the charge. But, you know, if we look through history, Diane, Victoria, we remember the phrase, you remember the phrase banned in Boston?
I don't.
Okay. Well, yeah, well, how old are you? I won't ask that on the air. She's much younger than me.
A little younger than you, Bill.
Yeah, and banned in Boston really got its roots because the first books that were banned in Boston. And there's an interesting quote, if you read about banning books on Wikipedia, I love Wikipedia, the rise of censorship in Boston led to the books being advertised as banned in Boston to promote sales throughout the rest of the United States. Eventually, the censorship aroused local opposition. An article in 1929's issue of the Harvard Crimson stated, it has become so tiresome to reproach Boston for their constant repression of creative work that we are beginning to surrender in despair. And I hope we don't surrender in despair. I think that's the reason why Vic and I do this every week, is to try to give people some hope. Because, you know, I tend to look at things a little bit from the more liberal perspective, and other people may look at it from the more conservative perspective. And there's blood on everybody's hands here, right, Vic, on banning books? I mean,
up
until 1966, the Catholic Church, thankfully, yes, has changed its ways, had a banned book list.
Yeah, and it started in the 1500s, and it went on for hundreds of years. And they finally, in the 1960s,
Pope Paul the Sixth, I think.
Stopped updating that list.
And so, you know, for various reasons, and it's interesting, Diane, I don't know if you've ever had to work with your censors on your book.
No. Okay. Nobody ever tried to censor. I mean, people did warn me that, as Vic mentioned, that there's a central plot point in the middle of it with people of different, with quite a big age difference. And people were like, whoa, that's going to be, that might put some people off. That's a little bit risky to put that in there.
Hey, I'll be honest, Diane. I was like, ooh, ew, gross. not in a bad way in terms of your writing, just like, I don't want to think about that. But I think, you know, we run into that in so many books where there's a theme that makes people kind of cringe, and it doesn't take away from the writing or the plot or any of that, but it does trigger certain people to be like, I don't want this in my kids' hands, therefore nobody should have access to it.
Yeah, and it, you know, I'm glad that you didn't have to deal with much of that. Many writers have to. Some are not able to defend themselves, like Mark Twain, who's the left has tried to ban his books in many cases because of language that they find offensive. Yet he's probably the greatest American writer we've ever produced, next to you, Diane. And I think that it's...
Oh, there you go.
Well, you're both from Connecticut. That's a good start right there. But it's so disingenuous for some of these groups. The Moms for Liberty, they, on their banner, on their headline is, Liberty Lost, Once Lost is Lost Forever by John Adams. I guarantee you that John Adams did not have banning books on his mind.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is notable there, right?
So whose liberty are we talking about? The liberty of people to read freely in a democracy without restrictions by their government? And here's the other thing, that they maybe if they some of these right-wingers are forgetting, some of the left-wingers, it's the government that's also censored. They've stopped books about the CIA when the CIA was in the 60s. The Frank Church Committee was trying to expose all the excessive operations in foreign countries that were done in our name, in the name of our democracy. It was terrible. Frank Church was a hero of mine growing up, and there was books about that that then they banned. So, you know, that's not giving the public the information they need to vote properly and to, you know, throw the bums out when the bums do bad things. So,
yeah. You know, I'm curious, Diane, I know you're a member of the Authors Guild, which is amazing. And there's been an effort through the Authors Guild to end book banning and to really put a stop to all this stuff that Bill's talking about. Have you had the the privilege, the ability to participate in any of these efforts? Or is there anything you can kind of share with us about that from your personal experience?
Well, I know I have been reading what the Authors Guild has been writing and some of the activities that they've been sponsoring. There's an organization they've teamed up with. It's just called UniteAgainstBookBans.org.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been Are you familiar with
that? I am, actually.
Yeah. So their website has a lot of information about events and tools and techniques that people can use in their own communities to try to fight against these bans. So I'm aware of that. And I guess
there's always the American Library Association, and they're out there in the
forefront. The librarians are very actively engaged in this. And then it's slightly different. There's an organization called FIRE, F-I-R-E, and they're very free speech oriented. They're not in favor of bans, whether it's the right or the left trying to ban a book or an idea or a speech or a program.
Mm-hmm.
They're First Amendment zealots, which I kind of am also. I believe anybody should be able to say or write or buy or read anything. And if you think it's a bad idea and you think it's inappropriate,
put it down.
Close the book.
Return it to the library.
And argue, write your own counter argument to whatever you think is
right.
Is the wrong idea in there. So I just think the tricky part, though, I think comes into play when it's not technically banning. The question is, any library, any bookstore, any home only has so much shelf space for books. So you have to pick and choose. You absolutely have to pick and choose what goes here now, what maybe has to go away to make room for something new coming out. No library carries all 500 biographies of Abraham Lincoln, for example. So it's a
well, they should.
They should, right.
All 500.
Build a wing.
I want to read them all. I love Abraham Lincoln.
He's amazing. That's why there's so many biographies about him.
Although I would recommend the Grant biography by Thomas Meacham.
Oh, it's fabulous. Have you read Grant's own memoirs?
Yes. Oh, my God, yeah. And
they're
amazing. We're talking about banned books and Mark Twain. Mark Twain was the one who published those.
I didn't know that.
Well, there was a magazine that was going to give Grant $500, and he had just had the first onset of his throat cancer, and he was desperate. In those eras, he had gone bankrupt because of his son's investments in Wall Street, which they blamed him for, but really didn't have much to do with him. He was a great president. Twain called him up, wrote him and said, listen, you can't do this. You have a great story. You got to tell it. And I'll get you, equivalent of millions of dollars today, which he did. And after Grant died, it was how Grant's widow survived because of Mark Twain, who was also a friend.
No,
I read
not
recently.
Know that.
Yeah. And,
Diane, Bill has so much knowledge in his brain. Every time we have a conversation, I'm like, how do you remember all of this stuff?
Well, Twain is somebody.
Walking history lesson.
If we want to teach about Connecticut history, we should teach a lot more about Mark Twain. I mean, he was one of the most progressive people we've ever produced from Connecticut. He was best friends with Helen Keller. They had a rally at Madison Square Garden to promote the health and well-being and economic opportunity of those with physical and mental disabilities.
Mm.
And this was
this
is around the turn of the century, right? And
okay.
and this is Mark Twain, who invested in printing presses and went bankrupt because he believed so much in the printed word.
I'm curious because I grew up in Trumbull, and we went on class trips to the Mark Twain house. I wonder if they're still doing that. My kids haven't gotten to that point yet.
Well, we're going to take a break in a little bit here. We got about another minute before the break, and I just want to sort of tease out the last segment and talk about how they're using the law to try and get these books banned. And it really boils down to the obscenity laws, which are very vague, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But if anybody wants to reach out to Moms of Liberty here in Fairfield County, the woman who's on their website, maybe you could talk some sense to her, Amanda Dombrowski. Her phone number is 645-797-0745. Maybe we can have her on the show and have her talk about
And that is on the website, so he's not...
Right, I'm not giving personal information. But, they say they're for liberty. I'd like to find out how you promote liberty by denying it.
Well, you should have her on. That would be fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could be polite. I'll try.
I'll be the adult in the room. Don't right. worry.
Because you said growing up. I'm still trying to figure out where I grew up, if at all. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break now on Wake Up here on WICC.
Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind. 203-333-9422.
We're back on Wake Up, and happy Sunday morning to everybody. As I said, we're taping the show a couple days before Sunday. Hope the week has turned out the way you planned it. We want to talk a little bit about the legal way that people are going after banning books. And the U.S. Supreme Court established the test that judges, the juries use to determine whether the matter is obscene. There was a famous case, Miller versus California, another one, Smith versus the United States. I'm not pretending to understand all the intricacies of these cases. I'm not a lawyer.
Well, we have Diane on the phone, and she is a lawyer.
And she is, and you know about Miller versus California, right?
Perfect.
Oh, yes. That's
a
pretty famous case.
Yeah. So there was the three-prong test in Miller. Just for our viewers, I'll just summarize them. Whether the average person applying contemporary adult community standards finds the matter taken as a whole appeals to prurient interests. You know, Captain Underpants is not prurient interests, right? I mean, whether it uses erotic, lascivious, abnormal, unhealthy, degrading, shameful, or morbid interest of nudity, sex, and excretion. Now, I can't think of anything in the books that we've reviewed here on Wake Up, Vic, can you, that would have met that first test? There's two more.
No, because I think it's all very subjective.
Sure.
Of course, yes. And it changes over time.
Yes.
You know, whether the average person applying contemporary adult community standards, talking about finds the matter depicts. Well, I'd hate to ask the current Supreme Court because we're going to get a real weird definition from these knuckleheads. The matter depicts or describes sexual conduct in a patently offensive way. None of the books, you know. Now there were episodes where children wrote about their being sexually abused. Mm-hmm. I don't say that's offensive. That's illegal. That's
well, right. I mean, I think it depends on how you define offensive, right? Like, well, I'm offended that these things occurred, not that you wrote about them.
In The Color, in All Boys Aren't Blue, George mm-hmm. Johnson's book, he talked about basically being raped by his cousin when the cousin was much older than him.
Right.
Now, he was a young boy, and he was very confused. He was just discovering his body. He didn't even understand what was going on. And he wrote about it many years later to try to guide other children, right?
Right.
So, you know, that's not what they had in mind when they talk about prurient interest. And the third is whether a reasonable person finds the matter taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Now, every single thing that I've read that's banned has serious literary components.
I think that's the one that really, for me, is the deal breaker, right? Because who are you as any layman to say this doesn't have artistic or literary value? I think, mm-hmm. you know, Diane, I don't know if you've heard our show in the past, but my recurring point is if any of the books we pick up and talk about can help one single human being process their trauma or get help for something that may have happened or identify that something happened and is wrong in their life or learn some sort of valuable life lesson, then its value is proven. You know, we've read books that had some very brutal themes in them, all the way down to, you know, last week we talked about The Giving Tree and the reasons that that was banned and challenged being that it was sexist and things like that. And it's like, but think about the value that these pieces of art, frankly, are providing. So, yes, it may be damaging to some and it may be offensive to some and it may make you cringe a little bit. But at the end of the day, there is value.
Well, let me just say, and I want to fill in Diane's quote here, but I mean, it makes you think.
Right.
Diane, that was one of the motives for writing you this book, right? To err is human, to forgive divine. That's one of the reasons why you wrote your book, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and as we mentioned earlier, I knew not everybody would be down with every single thing that was in the book, but I wrote it for thinking readers. I did not mm-hmm. write it for people who wanted to be spoon-fed. Think this, think that. These are the facts you must honor above other things. I wrote the book for people who like to get involved in the story and decide for themselves as they go along how they react, what's right, what's wrong, what they want to take away from it.
Yeah, and I won't spoil the end for anybody, but Diane, I hope that this
give us the title again, Vic.
It is Something Better by Diane Parrish. I will say the end of the book, I was so angry because I personally was like, but I don't understand how this is where you landed, you know, and not because, again, not because it didn't develop or wasn't well written, but because I personally had my own hangups that I was like, nope, I don't agree with you. What are you doing?
Exactly. You were invested in the story. And right. I knew there would be people who would say, no, she shouldn't have done that. She should have done this other thing. But she made her choice. And we are free as readers to respond to that choice in the way we respond. And I think that's to what you guys were talking about a few minutes ago. That's why it's so risky and so wrong for any, especially for a government entity, but for any entity to say, no, this is too dangerous. You can't read it. You can't have it. You can't think about it.
Right.
Because who are you to say, whoever you are, who are you
to
decide?
That's exactly the question.
Else?
Who are you to decide? You know, we talk a lot about banning books from a parental perspective. And again, I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, so some of this is a little further off where some of this may be a little, you
well,
know,
not Captain Underpants
in.
And the Lorax.
Right, and The Giving Tree.
The Giving Tree and the Lorax, yeah.
But I tend to look at things, again, from the perspective of, like, it's nobody else's business what my kid is reading. And a lot of book bans and challenges do focus on school libraries, which I can to some degree understand. You know, I don't want extremely vulgar things in my kid's elementary school library. But you know what? Sorry, as they get to middle and high school, they need to be exposed to more, because at some point we stop raising children and we're raising adults. They're walking out into this world and we can't have them do that unprepared. We can't throw another generation out there who has had limited exposure and therefore doesn't understand the realities, as ugly as they may be, of our world.
I have a throwback going through my mind right now of the Black Rock Library. When you walk up the stairs, to the left was the adult room and to the right was the children's room. And a shout out to Bina at the Bridgeport children's room down at the downtown library, because she's the one who guided my children. Find yourself a good librarian like Vic has, because I can't read all the kid books. You know, I don't know them all. And I would ask Bina and she'd give me great examples of books to read. And I never had an embarrassing moment when I was reading books to the kids where I read anything inappropriate. You know, I just I'd like to get both of you to react to this. I read books for two reasons. Number one, I'm very opinionated and I want to get research to to back up my opinion. Right. And then I also read books that I know I'm not going to agree with. You know, I read Senator Mike Lee, Charles Krauthammer, unfortunately, there's not a lot of intellects on the right anymore. Krauthammer was an intellect, and he was a brilliant man, and I really appreciated reading him. I didn't agree with him, but I really appreciated the way he developed ideas and presented them and didn't shove them down my throat. But tell me in the last couple of minutes here why you guys read.
I mean, I'll quickly say one is escapism, right? Life is hard, and there's a lot of stuff going on every day. And I feel a little bit hectic. You know, I work full time. I've got two kids that are running around everywhere. And being able to read, pick up a book or listen to an audiobook gets me out of my kind of personal panic a little bit. And then also audiobooks for me really help me focus, which I think I'm a bit of a minority in that. I listen to audiobooks all throughout the day and it helps me stay focused on the tasks that I have to.
You have the last word, Diane, before we finish up this edition of Wake Up. Tell us why you read and what you want, the last words you have for our listeners.
Okay, I read to learn. I read nonfiction books to learn. I love to read nature books about what's up with fungi and how the forests work. I love those kinds of books. And for fiction, I read to learn basically how other people do it. I know they're not real, but if they are well written, they become real. And I want to see how other people handle life's problems. And I love doing that.
I love that.
In addition to Something Better by Diane Parrish, available now, what would you read? What would you recommend?
Well, I love Claire Keegan. She's absolutely fantastic. I don't know if you guys have read her fiction. She writes short books that are absolutely perfect.
Say that again. Perfect. Say that again.
Claire. Her name is Claire Keegan. C-L-A-I-R-E-K-E-E-G-A-N. She's an Irish writer. I think she's absolutely magnificent. I also love Maggie O'Farrell, another Irish writer. I guess I'm going off on an Irish trend here, which I didn't know that I was doing. Let's see. Those are two of my favorites. I pick up anything by Elizabeth Strout that comes out new. I think she's terrific.
Well, and I really want to thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we want to thank also Deb Ziff, who helped put this show together for us, your promoter. And we look forward to doing more shows like this where we can talk to authors. If you know other authors, we'd love to get them on to talk about what motivates them and how they can wake up here on Sunday morning on WICC 600. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week here on the radio.